Well, good morning. It's good to be with you again. The topic of this talk should really be the geopolitics of AIDS. Yesterday we talked about the politics of AIDS, and this morning we're going to talk about the geopolitics of AIDS and try to put it into its international perspective. And you may wonder as the talk develops why, where AIDS comes into this, but I hope you'll understand by the time we get to the conclusion. When I was very young, I didn't understand poetry. It seemed like, something really wasn't very important. As I've matured and grown older, I've understood that poetry is a wonderful means of communication, because combining rhyme and ideas and words, why, you can transmit concepts which can be capsulized in such a short period. You can actually tell historical facts or truth, or you can even catch a glimpse of eternity or infinity through poetry. And the lessons of poetry often can be something that can be carried from generation to generation. One of the great poems written early in this century told of the story of the Great War, the First World War, the war to end all war. In Flanders field the poppies grow, between the crosses row on row, to mark our place, and in the sky the lark still singing bravely fly, scarce heard amidst the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders field where poppies grow. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from falling hands, we throw the torch. Is yours to hold on high. If you break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow on Flanders field. It was a great poem. It touched people's hearts. It was written, of course, by a man named John McCrae, who actually was at Flanders and saw the horror that took place. And the question then arises, but few people ever ask, who was the foe? I mean, take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from falling hands we throw, the torch is yours to hold on high. If you break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep in Flanders field. Now, many people wrote many books about the First World War. There were 30 million casualties. Died, wounded, 17 million civilians, 12 million soldiers. The English wrote a blue book and a white paper claiming it was the Germans. The Germans wrote a book claiming it was the English. The Kaiser, in his memoirs, said that he thought it was a secret Masonic conspiracy. There were innumerable books that named the merchants of death, the munitions manufacturers. They were the enemy. They were the ones who profited from the war. They must have been the cause of the war. There were books that said it was the Jewish bankers, and this led falsely to a great deal of anti-Semitism, which was at the basis of much of the anti-Jewish sentiment that existed in Europe, and some of it even in America. But nobody really ever understood the origins of that First World War. Well, before the morning is over, you are going to know, what very few people in America and the world really understand, how this whole thing came about. And perhaps to understand it even better, let me take you back 70 years from the time when John McCrae wrote the story of Flanders Field, back to the period in the 1840s, when one of America's great poets, James Russell Lowell, wrote about another moral crisis that faced America, similar to the moral crisis that we have today. He was writing about the moral crisis of slavery, that slavery was wrong. At those days, blacks were not felt to be human beings, just as children in the womb today are not felt to be human beings. And this is what James Russell Lowell recorded. Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide, in that strife of truth with falsehood, for the good or the evil side. It is then the brave man chooses, while the coward stands aside, until the multitudes make virtue of the faith they have denied. Though the cause of evil prospers, yet is truth alone 'tis strong. Though a lot may be the scaffold, and upon the throne be wrong. But that scaffold sways the future, for in the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch upon his own. And if you analyze what he's talking about a strife of truth with falsehood. and good and evil. And in the modern day, these concepts of evil are hard for people to accept. We are living in a day of relativism where homosexuality is an alternative lifestyle, where abortion is a matter of individual choice, where there seem to be no rights, no wrong. And yet James Russell Lowell was talking about the strife between evil and truth. In fact, there's always been a struggle between light and darkness, truth and falsehood, right and wrong, God and Satan, the Christ and the Antichrist. This is very real. And yet in America today, this concept of this struggle doesn't seem really to be real at all. Our reality are simply what we see on television. Our reality are the elections coming up in November, where we're having Democrats opposing Republicans. And oh boy, we hope the Republicans are going to win. Maybe we can change the direction in Washington. And yet if you look over history, you find it really doesn't many times matter who gets into political office. We seem to go along this same trend towards more government control, always towards this goal, this elusive goal of something called the New World Order. So let me do a brief encapsulation of the history of this last century, because you cannot understand what's happening today unless you understand history. It was in 1899 when a war broke out in an obscure part of the world which most Americans probably today still don't understand. It was something known as the Boer War. Now, it was a strange war. The Afrikaners, of course, were European, and as were the English settlers. The Afrikaners were in the Transvaal Republic. The Afrikaners certainly didn't want a war with the English. The English didn't want a war with the people of the Transvaal. They shared a common concern about their nation there. And yet the war occurred. And there were 5,000 Boers who were killed. There were 12,000 blacks who were killed. There were 25,000 English who actually were killed in battle or died of their wounds. A 5-to-1 ratio is a pretty poor ratio for the English army. It was one of the greatest defeats, despite the fact they won the war. And the only reason they won the war is because they rounded up the women and children. 25,000 women and children were put into concentration camps and died of typhoid. And the tremendous outcry from the English public when they realized this treatment of women and children who are not supposed to be combatants in war really turned the attitude of the entire British public against the war that they never really wanted to begin with. 150,000 dead or seriously wounded in the Boer War, and nobody ever understood its origins. The war ended in 1902. 12 years later, the war clouds loomed over Europe. The First World War was quite impossible to understand because everything had been done to prevent a war. All of the major rulers were related. The Tsar of Russia was a cousin of the Kaiser of Germany, who was a cousin of the King of England. Certainly nobody wanted this war, this horrible carnage where 30 million people, 30 million casualties of this war. I went to Europe in 1980 to try to understand the war. And then we walked through the battlefields at Argonne. You go to Verdun. At Verdun, on one field, there are 27,000 white crosses, French. And behind that is a gigantic mausoleum built over the graves of over 100,000 men who were so mutilated no one could figure out who they were. And they just dumped 100,000 bodies into that trench. And then they built a mausoleum over it to honor the honored dead. 400,000 Frenchmen fell at Verdun. 400,000 Germans fell at Verdun. If you travel that area of France, all you see are crosses. Oh, there are the American crosses, too. There's the crosses and stars. Every once in a while, you'll see that cross with the inscription, "Here lies in honored glory a comrade in arms, known only to God," because he couldn't be identified. It's an amazing story of a war that nobody could understand. But at the end of the war, the world changed forever. The Russian Empire was destroyed. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was destroyed. The Turkish Empire was destroyed. The German Empire was destroyed. And France and England would never be the same again. Immediately in the aftermath of the First World War, why, you saw the revolution in Russia. And then, according to Solzhenitsyn, about 60 million people were exterminated. Now, when you talk about 60 million people, that becomes a statistic. I mean, it's difficult to believe that they lived and felt dawn, saw sunset glow. loved and were loved, and yet this is the truth. This is the reality. 40, 60 million people, who knows how many died in the consolidation of power in the Soviet Union. Even more interesting is if you study the consolidation of power in the Soviet Union, there was a great deal of money that went from America to Russia. If you read Herbert Hoover's memoirs, Herbert Hoover was in charge of the relief mission. 95% of the countless millions of dollars that went not to the anti-communists, but to the communist forces. And it really didn't quite make sense. There were anti-communist armies that were fighting. There was were fighting the communists. There was the Army of the South, headed by General Denikin and then by General Wrangel. In General Wrangel's memoirs, he tells about how, I mean, they were getting weapons. They were doing a really pretty good job, and suddenly all of their weapons were destroyed. Their airplanes they bought were destroyed. All their weapons were cut off by the English, and they had no alternative but to retreat and leave the battlefield. The same thing happened with Admiral Kolchak in the Eastern Front, who initially was financed, and then suddenly all of his financing was cut off. And the communists, the small cadre of communists, were allowed to take control of Russia, and 60 million people were systematically exterminated. Well, it was 20 years after the battle flags had been furled in Europe when suddenly the war drums began to beat again. In 1938, we saw the advance of Germany, and by suddenly the Second World War came about. This war led to, of course, you know about the Holocaust and the 6 million Jews, which was a horrible story, but people seldom talk about the 3 to 4 million gypsies and Christians, both Catholic and Protestant, who were herded up and taken to the concentration camps. We never talk about that. All we ever talk about is the 6 million Jews, and our attention is focused on the 6 million Jews. Not that that wasn't horrible, but why don't we talk about some of the other things? 50 million people died or were seriously wounded in the Second World War. 50 million, yeah. I mean, these are statistics that are difficult for the human mind to grasp. You know, we are concerned about every individual who lives, and as a physician, as a doctor, human life is so important. When that patient arrives in the emergency room, you know, everybody gathers around and their IVs going in and x-rays and a team of 10 people, perhaps many times, trying to save that human life. We're talking about 50 million human beings. Each one who lived saw dawn, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, lived and loved and was loved. It's difficult for the mind to fathom this sort of thing. And then, of course, one of the great untold stories immediately followed the Second World War, and that's something known as Operation Keelhaus. There were many Russians who had either been captured by the Germans or who had defected to the Germans because they hated communism. And the Russian forces, the communists, said, if you are captured or you surrender, I mean, we will come and get you and bring you back, and you'll die a horrible death. And so you hear about the heroism of the Russians who were fighting, and that was simply because there was an army behind them that shooted if they retreated, and if they were captured by the other side, the communists said, we will get you. Well, after the Second World War, there were about 5.5 million Russians in the hands of the Americans and the British forces, who many of them were actually in America and in Canada, who were forcibly repatriated, and almost all of them were systematically slaughtered by the Russians. Now, you've never heard of this. The average American has never heard of Operation Keelhaul. There are a number of books written about this. The East Came West, Operation Keelhaul, The Secret Betrayal by Tolstoy, not Tolstoy who wrote War and Peace, but by his nephew. We have a video, a beautiful video that was put out by BBC that was never allowed to be shown in America, perhaps only once or twice, actually interviews with British Army officers who saw the Russians commit suicide rather than go back. Now, how do you kill 5.5 million people and keep it a secret from the American public and from the British public? Because few people understand this tragic part of history. And then, of course, there were literally hundreds of thousands of people who were taken from Eastern Europe and sent to the Gulag, where few of them returned. There were hundreds of thousands of Japanese at the end of the Second World War who were taken to Siberia. Few of them ever returned. And then, of course, by 1948, why China had gone communist. It's estimated that somewhere between 60 and 80 million Chinese have been systematically eradicated in this move to consolidation of power in China. And if you want the verification of the figures, we have them from the House Committee on Un-American Activities, which investigated it. Stephen Mosier, probably one of the world's leading experts on China, thinks the figure probably is higher than that. But, you know, it's difficult for people to imagine these numbers because they become only statistics when we think of something of that horror and that magnitude. And then, of course, by 1949, we were engaged in the Korean War, and we lost some 37,000 men. But we never talk about the probably 750,000 or 1 million Koreans who perished in that battle. And then in the intervening years, suddenly we were in Vietnam. We lost 47,000 men in Vietnam. But we never talk about the 1 million to 1.5 million Vietnamese who died in the horror of that. And since that time, there's been the revolution in Angola, and probably 1 million people died there. In Ethiopia, about 1 million people were starved to death, most of them Christians. In Sudan, about 500,000 have been starved to death, most of them Christians. In Mozambique, there has been a war. It's coming to a close now, but it's estimated that 500,000 to 1 million died there. Of course, you remember after Vietnam, there was Cambodia. It is estimated that about a third of the population was systematically exterminated by the Khmer Rouge. It's interesting, if you read your newspaper 8 years ago, you'll find out that America was backing the Khmer Rouge, and that really doesn't quite make sense, because the Khmer Rouge, the Pak Pol followers, were ruthless tyrants who systematically killed between 1 and 2 million Cambodians, and yet they had the full support of the American government a few years ago. Now suddenly they're the enemy again. You've recently seen what happened in Rwanda. I wonder how many of you really understand what happened in Rwanda. There were two major forces in Rwanda. One were the Tutsis, and they were Christians, and the others were the Hutus, and they were occultists. They were devil worshippers as such. And so the devil worshippers set out to kill the Tutsis, and they killed about 500,000 of them. Now, you never understood what the war was really all about, because you weren't supposed to. And then the Tutsis went back into Uganda, and they reformed, and they moved back in, and they took the country back. At that point, of course, suddenly there's tremendous talk about this. Bill Clinton is saying, never use the word genocide. You know, that would mean we'd have to go ahead and do something about that. That's what he said to his followers there in the White House. Don't ever use the term, because if there was a genocide, we'd have to be involved. Once the Tutsis, the Christians, were back in control, then America allowed the United Nations to intervene, but not until then. The story of the carnage which has existed in this last century is almost beyond the imagination to define. And then let's look at the environmental movement. You know, the environmental movement has come up to create all sorts of enemies. One of the greatest enemies of all was DDT. Now, DDT is probably the safest insecticide we've ever had. When I was in medical school, they told a story about a group of people working in a warehouse who wanted to bake a cake, and they thought that the DDT in the barrel was flour, and so they baked a cake, and they ate the cake, and nothing happened to them. I mean, but because it caused the softening of the shell of some obscure bird, and of course, most of what you've heard about DDT just isn't true, but because it caused the softening of the shell of some obscure bird, they stopped using DDT. Now, what that meant was that in the tropical areas, they could not use it for spraying and control of the mosquitoes, and about 3 million people then die every year of malaria, unnecessarily. We could save those lives, but we can't use the DDT because of international agreements. That means that over a period of 30 years, about 100 million people have died, simply as a result of failure to use DDT. And, of course, you can justify that by saying, well, you know, we've got to protect the environment. But 100 million people. And then, of course, we could talk about this new move they're going to do away with Freon in another year or two because of the non-existent ozone hole, and that's going to do away with refrigerants in most of the third world countries, which will be just too expensive, and you won't be able to store food, and you won't be able to store medicines and blood and things like that. And it's estimated that this will result in a dramatic increase in the death toll within the tropical third world countries throughout the world. And then, of course, we look at the abortion issue. America's 35 million children that have been aborted in America. Throughout the world, the figures may be ranging, since Russia is the major means of birth control in Russia, is not contraceptives, but abortion. You're probably looking somewhere around 500,000,000 unborn children whose lives have simply been snuffed out in this abortion holocaust over the last 30 years, 20 years, I guess 1972. It's been 22 years since Roe versus Wade. And then we look at the AIDS situation. Now, those of you who heard my talk yesterday will remember me quoting Dr. William Hazeltine, who's professor of cancer biology and human virology back at Harvard University. He holds two professorships. And in his classic speech, which any of you can get if you write to me, given to the French Academy of Science in November of 1992, he mentioned that he felt that it could well be that by the end of this decade, we could have 100 million people infected, and by the end of the first decade of the next century, we could have 1 billion people infected if the epidemic continued spreading at its current rate, literally exploding throughout Africa and throughout Asia. Now, it's interesting to note that when that article was republished in American newspapers, specifically I have Priorities magazine and, of all things, the Servant of Washington Times, any mention of 1 billion people infected and going to die from AIDS was carefully deleted. In fact, we get conflicting stories about AIDS all the time. Sometimes we're told it's leveling off, and sometimes we're told it's increasing, and sometimes we're told that the incidence of new cases is falling off. And there's a great deal of disinformation and confusion out there as far as the AIDS epidemic and what it's going to mean as far as the future of our nation and the future of the world is concerned. Now, it's interesting to study what's actually happened in America as far as this epidemic is concerned. In fact, let me take you back into the period of the 1940s. You know, the 40s were the end of the war. America was victorious. Everything was going to be great. Suddenly, the economy was beginning to move forward. The industry was converting from wartime to peacetime. We could buy new cars. In 1947, the Supreme Court came out with a peculiar decision. They began talking about a wall of separation between church and state. Now, they didn't change anything as far as prayer or the public was concerned, but they established this idea that somehow there was a wall of separation they just recently recognized. And then in 1948, the Kinsey Report came out, and the Kinsey Report said that 10% of our population was homosexual, that most people were promiscuous, that bestiality was perfectly all right, that, because it was being done, and that meant it really had to be all right. Most farm boys engaged in it at one time or another. That pedophilia, the real harm with pedophilia was parents got so upset when children were molested by homosexual men or little girls were molested by men. And it was mainly the concern of the parents reflected on the child that was the real problem. It wasn't the violation of the child's innocence. And so people began to read the Kinsey Report, and this began the rumblings of the changing of sexual mores in our society. By the 1950s, of course, we had antibiotics readily available for any form of venereal disease. And suddenly, whereas before you had to worry about syphilis and gonorrhea, they talked about penicillin as the after-diddlement, and we began to see increasing sexual promiscuity within our society. And, of course, by the end of the 1950s, contraceptive pills were becoming available, and so there were less and less barriers to sexual promiscuity. In 1961, there was a gentleman named Harry Hay. And most of you have never heard of Harry Hay, but Harry Hay is the man who is responsible for the gay liberation movement. There's a wonderful book written. It's called The Trouble with Harry Hay. Harry Hay was a communist, a hardline communist, who left the Communist Party to form the gay liberation movement. And the purpose of the gay liberation movement was to change America. His efforts culminated in 1969 in what came to be known as the Stonewall Riots, where homosexuals in a bar which was being raided by the police fought back, and suddenly it was said, well, the police will no longer do anything to disrupt homosexuality, at least not in New York City. But Harry Hay began to move to create a liberation movement in America for homosexuals, similar to the liberation movement that had existed previously in Cuba and in Vietnam and in Algeria, and it was an effort to change our society. By 1962, the Supreme Court in the case Engle versus Vitale proclaimed that there really was a wall of separation between church and state, and they outlawed a horrible prayer. I think it was something like, God is good, God is great, thank you for this food, amen. And we established that we could no longer have morality taught in our schools. By 1963, President Kennedy died. 1964, we were involved in Vietnam. 1965, 1966, the hippie movement, the drugs, the beginnings of the sexual revolution. 1970 were the swinging 70s. You see, there were no barriers. 1972, we had Roe versus Wade, and there were no barriers to sexual promiscuity. If you got pregnant, you had an abortion. If you wanted to be promiscuous, you wanted to live with your boyfriend, you just took the pill. If you got a disease, you took a shot, you took a pill. There were no barriers. We had a wonderful society. You could do whatever you want to. And then, of course, June 5th, 1981 came. And June 5th, 1981 was the watershed for America. It was a watershed for the entire world, because that day in the MMWR, the Morbidity and Mortality Report, put out, a weekly report put out by the Centers for Disease Control, there appeared a one-paragraph notice. Now, there were three things that happened that week that the CDC wrote about. The first and most important one is that there were three cases of dengue fever that had been found in transients or in visitors of people coming back from South America. Dengue is breakbone fever. It's found very rarely in America, and there were three cases that they found in American tourists to South America. Second article dealt with the fact that we were bringing the measles epidemic under control, and soon measles would no longer be a plague in America. And the third article was one paragraph. It simply announced that five homosexuals who went to homosexual bathhouses, engaged in something called fisting, used various sexual stimulants, had come down with a disease called pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, which was never seen except in older Mediterranean men. But it was five of them in young homosexual men. This was indeed strange. That's all it said. First instance where we're finding this disease in younger men. It's composed of sarcoma that's actually found in Mediterranean. Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia is only found in people who are immunosuppressed. Well, within a week or two after that, you begin seeing new articles talking about Kaposi sarcoma, which is seen primarily in men of Mediterranean origin, older men. And suddenly you're beginning to see homosexuals developing all sorts of diseases that are associated with an altered or impaired immune system. Well, at that point, the Centers for Disease Control did what it's supposed to do. It set out epidemiologists all across the country to interview everybody with these horrible diseases, almost all homosexuals initially, and find out if there was a common denominator. And within a relatively few months, they found out one man. His name was Gaetan Degas, and he was a French-Canadian airline steward, and he could be directly connected with about eight cases of this disease. And so they brought him to Atlanta, Georgia, and this was in April of 1992, and he was very cooperative. He had his little black book. He had 250 different sexual partners every year, and of course, many of these he had sex with multiple times, and most of his time he was flying, so you could imagine what was going on. So they said, well, you know, we have definitely determined that you are a vector for this disease. Eight of your partners have the disease, and actually they were able to figure out that there were 40 people, either directly or indirectly, that infected. Eight directly and 40 indirectly. In other words, people he had infected others. So they said to him, you've got to stop being promiscuous. And he said, why should I? I mean, somebody gave me the disease. I'm going to give it to others. And knowing full well that he intended to continue spreading the disease, the officials at the Centers for Disease Control allowed him to leave, to move to San Francisco, where he continued spreading the disease for many, many months until he was driven out of town by the homosexuals. And then he went to Vancouver and continued spreading the disease. And when I've asked officials of the CDC, why did you allow him to continue spreading the disease? Don Francis, who's the hero of the HBO docudrama And the Band Played On, and also the hero of the book by the same name, And the Band Played On, we talked about yesterday. Don Francis said, well, he was very cooperative. Now, the man who killed Polly Klass in California was very cooperative, but who among you would feel that he should be released to go out and kill again? And yet, this disease was to be handled differently than other diseases. By January of 1983, it was definitely determined that the blood supply was infected. And so the leaders of the American blood banking industry were invited to come to Atlanta, Georgia, and there they were told that the blood was infected. They had, since we did not have a test for the organism that created the disease, in fact, at that time, they weren't even sure what the organism was. It wasn't until March of that year when the French identified the HIV virus. But the blood banking industry was told that they had to start doing hepatitis B core antigen testing because that would identify homosexuals. 80% of homosexuals were infected with hepatitis B. If you did hepatitis B core antigen testing, you threw out the blood, you'd do away with 80% of the infected blood. And the blood banking industry said, we're not going to. In the HBO docudrama and in The Band Played On, the story is told of Don Francis, who I just mentioned, you know, pounding on the table and said, how many bodies do you want? How many people are going to die because before it becomes so expensive, you're going to have to do what's right? But the blood banking industry refused to do what was right. As a result, probably 10,000, somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 people who got transfusions have progressed to death. I think 7,000 have died so far. But even more tragic than that were the hemophiliacs. Now, the Hemophiliac Foundation, which was financed by the blood banking industry, kept telling the hemophiliacs, don't worry. There's nothing to worry about. I mean, the cryoprecipitate is perfectly safe. As a result, half of America's hemophiliacs have become infected. That is 10,000 hemophiliacs are infected. Many of them infected their wives, and the wives infected their children. 3,000 are already dead, and the rest are simply waiting to progress to terminal disease. They're horrible stories. There's one family, there were seven boys, one died at birth, five of them have died of AIDS. One is still living, he's infected, his wife's infected, their children are infected. And this is a direct byproduct of the fact that the blood banking industry refused to do what was right. And not only that, but they refused to tell the public what was going on. In fact, it was in 1984 when Secretary of Health and Human Services, Margaret Heckler, went on television and said, we can assure you the blood supply is perfectly safe. And yet they knew that they were killing people. Well, it was in March of 1985 when the blood test became available. And this was going to allow us to test the entire population and stop this epidemic. But that was not in the agenda. Because, you see, the gay activists went to the Federal Drug Administration and said, don't you dare release that test for general use. You can use it to test the blood supply if you want to, but you can't use it to test the general population, because if you are going to do that, we're going to bring an injunction so you can't release this at all, and you can't test the blood, and people are going to die because they're going to get infected blood, and it's going to be your fault. And of course, the people in the blood banking, people in the FDA said, oh, well, we won't release it for general use at this time. At that point, the gay activists, but you must understand, they work in conjunction with a radical and revolutionary left. I went to all the state legislatures, and in literally every state in the entire union, they got special laws, consent laws for testing, special confidentiality laws, special counseling requirements, where doctors were supposed to spend 15 to 30 minutes counseling people before the blood test was administered, and this was specifically designed to prevent general testing. It was in February of 1987, when the Centers for Disease Control called the 200 public health officers to Atlanta to talk about beginning to do widespread testing, premarital testing, prenatal testing, all the things we do with syphilis, all the things we would ordinarily do if we wanted to stop the epidemic. 900 people showed up, most of them gay activists. They yelled, they screamed. After the meeting, and we tell the story in my book, because we have the writings from the homosexual publications. One homosexual bragged in the homosexual publication, this was the Gettysburg for testing in America. No one will ever again dare suggest that we do widespread testing. And that was true. Nobody at the meeting, after being yelled and screamed at, had the courage to hold up their hand. I think only one public health officer in the entire nation held up his hand when they asked how many wanted to do premarital testing, because they were all afraid. And as I told you yesterday, I've been told repeatedly by public health officers, sure, we know what you're doing is right, Stan, but we can't back you publicly because we've been threatened. And all across America, anybody who has stood up and tried to do what was right has had their life threatened, has had their profession threatened, has come under tremendous personal pressure. And I probably have had less than a lot. Dr. Lorraine Day, if you read my book, the stories about her, they threatened to throw acid in her face, kill her family. She had to travel with a bodyguard in 1988 when we were trying to get legislation through. And yet the homosexuals are the ones who are dying. And this really doesn't make sense. Well, we could tell you the story of the events as they unfolded during those years. I first got involved in 1986, went before the House of Delegates at night, which I was a senior member at this time, and said, look, you members of the House of Delegates of the California Medical Association have to recognize we have a major epidemic in America. We've got to start addressing it. We've got to change consent and confidentiality requirements so we can address this epidemic as we do all other epidemics. And the doctors overwhelmingly voted that, yes, we ought to just treat HIV disease like all other diseases. And I thought that was the end of the battle. I'm going to go back and practice orthopedics and be involved in all my other activities. And of course, what was surprising was later that year when the legislation actually came through, California Medical Association had not backed the position taken by the House of Delegates. In fact, they'd actually gone to Sacramento and lobbied against those positions. Well, I wasn't very smart at the time. I didn't realize really the forces that I'd engaged inadvertently. And so in 1987, I went back before the House of Delegates, and this time we had a very effective public health program, because remember, I'm an orthopedist. I mean, this is not my field, but we had some help, and the doctors in my community, we wrote out a very effective public health program to address the epidemic, and once again, the doctors overwhelmingly voted to support it. But now we were going to be really clever. We had, at that time, a close liaison with Senator Doolittle. He was the state senator today. He is Congressman Doolittle from the Sacramento area. And he rewrote his legislation word for word to correspond to the CMA policy. So now we really had him. Boy, did we have him. And so the House of Delegates voted to support our program, and we got the legislation submitted supporting CMA policy. And once again, CMA went to Sacramento and lobbied against their own policy, word for word, written exactly as the House of Delegates had put it out. Well, about this time, I began to realize there had to be some other agenda. This just wasn't quite right. It was in April of that year when we sent one of our members of our medical society back to Chicago, where the American Medical Association was meeting. And nobody is ever allowed to speak from the podium at most meetings, other than the Orthopedic Society, where Dr. Lorraine Day has been allowed to speak. But usually nobody is allowed at the major AMA meetings to tell what really needs to be done using standard public health techniques to address the epidemic. But our doctor, when the questions and answers came from the floor, he stood up, said what our society stood for, sound public health policy, overwhelming applause from the audience, because they knew what needed to be done. But nobody was allowed to speak from the podium who wanted to do what was right. It was in May of that year when Ronald Reagan addressed AMFAR, the Americans for AIDS Research, in Washington, D.C., and he advocated routine testing, premarital and prenatal testing, and he was booed from the audience. It was in June of 1987 when I read in the communist publication something that really made me realize that there was something behind this epidemic. And basically what they said was, you know, millions of lives are at stake. Everybody's life is going to be touched by this epidemic in America. Don't allow testing. And suddenly, why would the communists not want to allow testing? They're testing in Cuba. They're testing in Russia. Most of the Russian population had been tested. They'd already tested 50 million people at that time in Cuba. I mean, they tested the entire population. Why couldn't we test in America? Oh, we couldn't violate civil rights. Well, we could take you through the subsequent events as they've unfolded. Let me, though, take you to the meeting of the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association held in September of last year in the eastern part of this country. At that meeting, the featured speakers were Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Robert McNeil of McNeil Lair. The New York Times and the Washington Post were both there recruiting people to come to work, homosexuals to come to work for the publications. Now, I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that these people are homosexual at all. I am suggesting, however, that the homosexual movement is being used for a political purpose, and that is to disrupt our society. If you read my book, I quote from Larry Kramer, founder of ACT UP, the AIDS Committee to Unleash Power, where he talks about what we need in America is an AIDS terrorist army similar to the Ergun. Well, the Ergun was a terrorist organization in Palestine that overthrew the government. And basically, there are people who would like to disrupt our society, and Larry Kramer is one of them. But what I'd like to suggest to you is that there are forces and powers that work within our society that most people have no glimpse of. So I'd like to take you back in time, back to the 1500s, early 1600s. This was the time of the Renaissance, when man came to believe that he no longer needed God. It was turning their back on the traditions of what is referred to as the Dark Ages. They really weren't Dark Ages at all, and yet this is a phrase that we use, that we call it the Middle Ages, if you want to. But it was an age where there were right and wrong, and when people knew that the people always going to violate God's law, but it was turning our back, and there were suddenly men who said, you know, we don't need God anymore. We can make a better society. And there are two separate tracks that emerge from that that time. One of them would be the occult, and the other would be the humanistic. And each one of those separate tracks divides along the way. And each track converges with the other. The first track would be the occult or the Masonic movement, which seemed to originate in the 1600s. Although if you read Masonic literature, they will tell you they've always been there, and they date their origins back into Babylon and to the ancient wisdom of Chaldea, into the ancient wisdom of Egypt, to the Knight Templars. Trouble is, the Knight Templars were actually disbanded in the 1300s on order of the French king because they were Luciferian. But of course, most Masons don't understand that. And the reason that Jacques Dumoulin, for whom the Dumoulin clubs was burned at the stake, was because of the Luciferian basis of the Templars, who had been involved in the Crusades and had taken over the wisdom of the occultists in the Near East and brought it back to Europe, where they became extremely wealthy and extremely powerful and also extremely occult. Well, the Masons developed, and of course they were a wonderful cover because they were a secret society, and within the lodges themselves, you were sworn that if you ever were to divulge the secret, your tongue would be torn out and you'd be buried in the water up to your chin, and that your heart would be torn out and your entrails would be fed to the birds and burned, and all sorts of horrible things if you ever divulged any of the secrets. So this was a wonderful place by which people could begin to conspire against overthrowing existing governments. And so it was that even in America, the Masonic movement was here. It was here before the American Revolution. But you have to understand that Masonry is sold initially as a Christian organization. And for those people entering Masonry, they honestly believe it's Christian. You've got a Bible there, and they talk about Jesus, the Son of God. It's only when you get to the higher echelons of Masonry you find really the secrets of the occultic nature and the Luciferian basis upon which Masonry exists. Now, 2 months and 3 days before the Declaration of Independence was signed, a very important event occurred in Ingolstadt, Bavaria. At that time, a man named Adam Weishaupt, who was a professor of law, common law, he had actually been a Jesuit, turned against the Jesuit faith, and he formed a secret society which was known as the Illuminati. And the Illuminati was basically aimed at overthrowing all existing governments, overthrowing all belief in God, and creating a new world order under the control of a ruling elite. And it existed, and it grew, and it had a tremendous impact in Europe. It actually infiltrated the Masonic lodges of Europe and then became the rallying cry for the French Revolution. And if you read Masonic books, they will tell you we were instrumental in creating the French Revolution. Liberty, equality, fraternity was our slogan. And what it really means is you should subjugate yourself to those above you who are much more wise and much more knowledgeable. Well, of course, the American Revolution came about following the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776. And America then, as an independent nation, was created. And then in 1789 came the French Revolution, motivated and energized in large part by illuminated Freemasonry and also by the humanistic movement, each one of which hoped to overthrow the existing government and create what they hoped would be a utopian world order without the God of the Bible. Now, the occultists, believe in the wisdom that comes from the ancient masters and from all these ethereal organizations that come from the knowledgeable people who live in the Himalayas, and they have all sorts of